One of the nation's largest banks has been hacked. JPMorgan Chase is working with a federal task force to figure out who might be responsible for the cyber attack. The bank says so far it's not seeing any increase in fraudulent activity. Several other big banks were also reportedly hit. NPR's Jim Zaroli has more.
JPMorgan says hackers try to access its computers nearly every day without success. But this time they were able to break in, and one source said whoever was responsible was able to get deep into the company's network. Today, dozens of cybersecurity employees at the bank were trying to figure out the scope of the attack, and they were assisted by a Secret Service task force that includes the FBI. Tom Pagler is chief information security officer at DocuSign and a former JPMorgan cybersecurity official.
They're going to put all this through and run this down and figure out what happened, but it can take some time. And, you know, this is the kind of company, though, that does have the funds to do that, and they want to know what happened, both to protect their customers, but also understand it and make sure it doesn't happen again.
So far, at least, there are more questions about the attack than answers, and speculation is rampant about how it was carried out. The hackers reportedly also tried to attack the networks of at least four other big banks, but a source said if they did, there's no evidence they gained access. And some of the country's biggest banks said today that they haven't been hacked. The attacks appeared to have come from somewhere in Eastern Europe, and Bloomberg reported that the attack may have been a Russian retaliation for U.S. economic sanctions against the country. Raul Kashyap, head of security research at Bromium Labs, says that's certainly possible.
It wouldn't be surprising if it is coming from there. Some of the Russian underground gangs have a reputation of really being sophisticated. So I wouldn't be surprised if that were true, because they have built some high-quality malware in the past.
But U.S. officials cautioned that it was far too soon to attribute the attack to people in Russia or anywhere else. Computer hackers can be good at covering their tracks and making it look like they're in one location when they're really somewhere else. Kashyap said it will take a long time to get to the bottom of things.
They have to dig deep. It could take weeks, sometimes even months, to kind of get to the full extent of the damage.
Whoever was responsible, Kashyap says, the attack is disturbing. JPMorgan Chase is known for spending a lot of money on computer security, and its defenses against hackers are said to be the gold standard in the industry. So the fact that JPMorgan's network can be penetrated says something about just how vulnerable other big institutions are. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
This is a story about the salmon cannon. Yes, you did hear me correctly, salmon cannon. And better than me trying to explain what it is and how it works, we've called up one of the inventors, Vince Bryan. He is the CEO of Whoosh Innovations, and he's in Bellevue, Washington. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
First off, I should say this is a serious invention for a serious problem. The numbers of wild salmon species have plummeted. In many places, dams block salmon migrating to their spawning grounds. Fish ladders are expensive and often don't work. Where there are not ladders, fish have to be trucked or even helicoptered over the dams. But Vince Bryan, you came up with a different way to move fish. Can you explain what the salmon cannon is?
The salmon cannon is really a device that we have created to move objects gently. And it works by a pressure differential. And so it's a misnomer in that respect. It looks a little bit like a cannon, but the fish do move very quickly, and they come out of the end back into the water as if they were shot out of the end of a cannon.
What I don't understand is why you think that these fish are fine after they come out the end of it. I mean, they come flying out.
In reality, from the very beginning of the test, that was a concern. Can the fish be out of water? Although it may be just 10 seconds to go as much as 250 feet, but the fish handled that very well. And so there seems to be no effect. The fish enter into the water and swim away.
Now, as I understand it, you invented this technology for fruit, apples and pears.
Correct. The initial problem that we were trying to solve was how do we allow for picking of a piece of fruit such that the picker isn't wasting so much time going up and down the ladders, and that's what's ultimately led us to the salmon cannon.
So are there any other things that you have moved through the tube?
You know, we've been asked to put a number of things through. But one of the more fun ones that we did was we were asked to put potatoes through the tube. And at the end of the tube, they delivered to us a French fry cutter. And and so the potatoes went through the tube. And then as a whole potato, when they came out the other side, they were French fries.
Is it conceivable that you could move people in tubes like this?
Yes, is the answer to that. And we've had a lot of volunteers along the way as we've been doing our testing. We haven't produced a tube that large yet. There's really no limit as to what we can move.
I can think of a lot of problems of moving people in tubes, you know, things like high-heeled shoes or handbags or luggage or whatnot.
Well, you're getting awfully big. in theory, it would all work. The biggest concern from our perspective in moving a person is just what is the method of slowing that person down. It's not going to be moving them. It's going to be gently landing them.
Vincent Bryan is the CEO of Whoosh. This weekend, the Salmon Cannon, which was bought by the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife, goes operational. It'll be on a tributary of the Columbia River. Mr. Bryan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's not just big production companies making nature documentaries these days. For years now, people equipped with durable GoPro cameras have been shooting videos from the front of a surfboard or the tip of a ski and posting them online. And starting this week, GoPro made it even easier to attach the camera to your pet. NPR's Tom Dreisbach has the story.
Dude.
Here's a typical mega-popular YouTube video shot with GoPro cameras. Guy's climbing a desert cliff.
This is scary, man.
Guy sees precarious-looking zipline hundreds of feet above a canyon floor.
This looks so damn scary, dude.
But this guy is not going to let this line go unzipped.
Are you ready? Yeah, buddy. Ready, steady. Spaghetti.
And with the vicarious thrill of YouTube, we can all fly above the canyon together.
Yeah! That was so scary!
This type of video is GoPro's bread and butter. From extreme sports like dirt biking...
Oh my god!
...to backcountry skiing or urban kayaking...
Whoa, that was so rowdy!
What makes these videos possible are the highly durable, waterproof HD cameras... and the mounts, which allow people to attach those cameras to a helmet, a ski, a surfboard, or a dog. The latest mount released this week is called the GoPro Fetch, and it was designed by this guy.
My name is Josh Drucker. I'm manager of the Advanced Mounts Group here at GoPro.
In fact, Drucker leads a 5-person team with basically one job, create cool new ways to attach GoPro cameras to different stuff.
Yes, I have one of the best jobs in the world.
The idea for a dog mount actually came from GoPro users who were finding all sorts of ways to record a dog's eye view. So Drucker says the company did a lot of field testing to create an official harness that would fit all shapes and sizes.
It's not just size testing that you're looking for, it's kind of the skeletal structure underneath. Like Dobermans are very angular and narrow, whereas you take something like a Newfoundland and it's very broad and hairy.
Now, Josh Drucker is himself not a dog owner.
I am not a dog owner, but I have 2 kids. I won't say that I put the harness on them.
But you're not saying it.
Yes. There may be some therapy later where this comes up.
So kids, dogs, a really friendly cat. This new harness could fit a lot of different stuff.
All right, come on.
Even a pig that surfs.
Where's your favorite surf spot? Sandy Beach?
That's one of GoPro's proudest users, Kai Holt, and his surfing pig, Kama.
He doesn't even know.
And while you might not believe there's really a pig that can stand on a surfboard in the Pacific, there it is, caught on camera. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
The sharing economy, as it's come to be known, has grown dramatically over the past few years. I'm talking about peer-to-peer transactions, like Airbnb, which lets people rent out an extra room, or the various ride-sharing services like Lyft or Sidecar. It seems pretty win-win, right? One person gets some extra cash for a car seat or a bedroom that's going empty. The other gets a cheaper car ride to the airport or a place to stay for the weekend. In a piece for the online magazine Aussie, Pooja Bhatia writes about one undesired byproduct this trend has created, oversharing. Hi, Pooja.
Hi, Arun.
So you write that the sharing economy demolishes barriers that you just as soon keep up. Explain this oversharing that's bugging you.
Well, sometimes you just want a ride to the airport, right? Sometimes you want to rest without having to make nice with the host. But there's another aspect, too. I don't like services that kind of muddle commercial transactions with friendships.
Now, I know you've had a few run-ins with these overshares in your time. Can you tell us about your first Airbnb host? This is a man you've nicknamed Sad Divorcee.
Well, he had recently moved out of his family home. So over the course of about a week or 10 days, I got the impression that part of the reason he was actually renting out extra rooms on Airbnb was so that he would have someone to talk to. And that's it's a sad situation, right? You know, you want to offer compassion, but you also don't necessarily want to be someone's therapist when you're paying $90 a night to stay in his place.
Have you had any good interactions, or are they all kind of intrusive, invading your privacy somehow?
I really do sound like a curmudgeon, don't I?
Well, I don't think most people would want to, you know, come home to their hotel room and have a, you know, concierge that complains about their ex-wife. So maybe not.
Yeah. No, I have had some nice experiences. One of them was with a woman I nicknamed Hippie Abuela. She also rented out a few rooms in her apartment. And she was great. But I decided that what made her really great was that she didn't force me to talk to her. The conversations that we had unfolded really kind of gradually.
Now, this is not just a problem for the sharing economy. I've had more than a couple of taxi drivers in New York that have overshared in pretty disturbing ways.
Yes. But the repercussions are different, right? So if you use, for instance, Sidecar, you can rate your drivers afterward. And, you know, similarly, if you take a taxi ride and the driver is inappropriate, you can call the TLC, you can report him. But it turns out after sharing this sort of simulacrum of friendship with someone who is providing you a service, no matter how brief, it's really hard to give someone a bad review. It just feels like you're being mean.
Huh. So you know, I was going to say that one of the advantages might be that you could give the person a bad rating for invading your privacy, but you don't feel good about doing that either?
I actually don't, and I don't think I'm the only one. I think that there is a reason on Airbnb, for instance, that they have separate review slots. So you write one review that shows up on the host profile, but then you can submit other comments to Airbnb that the host won't see, to kind of suggest that other people might be having this issue.
Pooja Bhatia is an editor and writer for the online magazine Ozzy. Pooja, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Arun.
A new record has been set on the fundraising website Kickstarter for over $11 million. That beats the former record of $10.2 million, which was raised for a smart watch. But this time it is not for a watch, an independent film, an art installation, or a community park. It's for a cooler. It's called the Coolest Cooler. And it is the kind you put drinks in. Here to explain what his cooler does and what made his campaign so successful is the creator, Ryan Grubber. Ryan joins us from New York City. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I wonder, first of all, I think I'm not alone when I say I was surprised to hear that the highest grossing Kickstarter campaign was for a cooler. What does this cooler do that got investors so excited?
Well, you have a built-in blender, so you can have your blended drinks. It has Bluetooth speakers, so you can listen to your music. And then other functionality that just doesn't exist in coolers today, like simply a bottle opener, big wheels, so you can actually roll your cooler across the ground, and then a tie-down strap, so you can carry your gear with it.
This is not the first time you've tried to launch your cooler with a Kickstarter campaign. What happened the first time?
Well, the short story is I failed. Around 9 or 10 years ago, I built my own blender out of a weed whacker to bring to the beach and entertain my friends. And then I put my car stereo in an old cooler years ago. And last year, when I finally pulled these out of deep storage after having kids, neither of them really worked. And I thought, wow, this is my opportunity for a Kickstarter project, when I saw the reaction that my friends and family had. And we launched that campaign, but it just didn't reach its funding goal.
So what'd you do? You've got the same product, so it must have been something you did.
Well, it was. Kickstarter and crowdfunding in general is a very visual platform. And so I went ahead and I moved the design a lot farther along to the production-ready state that we are right now, so people could really see what the product looked like. And then we did a lot more due diligence, really taking the coolest out to tailgates, other events, building up this fan base and list of potential backers that we had ready to go on that day one.
So homework, that's the key.
One of the biggest failure points for many campaigns is this expectation that my great product can stand on its own, where really many campaigns might launch and they're spending their short campaign window trying to reach out and connect with these potential backers. And they may not, you know, have done the homework to find out the best way to communicate what it is that your product can help other people with. Why should people care?
Ryan Grepper is creator of the Coolest Cooler. He spoke to us from New York. Ryan, thank you very much for this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Star Trek geeks, like me, delight in talking about the technological advances predicted on the show. Cell phones, tablet computers, 3D printing, Google Glass, medical telemetry. There's a new push to bring another device from the USS Enterprise to the mainstream, the medical tricorder. That's the gadget Dr. McCoy would use to diagnose anyone who got sick. He'd scan it over them as it made its signature sound. The XPRIZE Foundation launched the Qualcomm Tricorder XPRIZE competition in 2012, challenging teams of scientists all over the world to design an instrument able to capture vital signs and diagnose 15 diseases. The finalists were announced this week. Grant Campany is a senior director with the XPRIZE Foundation.
There's a need for a health system that really is responsive to the needs of the population. And a lot of these diseases and conditions that we're talking about result from many different variables, from the environment, your genetics, and your own behavior. What we don't have is an effective means to measure all of these things and to take these data points simultaneously and over a period of time. And these devices will be engineered ultimately to do that.
Over 300 teams initially registered to compete for the $10 million prize. Now it's down to 10.
The teams that actually are in the top 10 had to submit a large amount of data to explain to us and to judges how they were going to go about diagnosing things from anemia, urinary tract infection, diabetes, arterial fibrillation, stroke, as well as monitor 5 vital signs continuously for 72 hours. So it's a pretty audacious goal.
The finalists are from all over the world, from the U.S., Taiwan, Slovenia, India, Canada, and they're all taking different approaches to the challenge.
They're looking at a myriad of technologies, things that measure the volatile compounds in your breath, things that measure your pulse, using sources of light in even photo optics. So you can imagine having sensors in your clothes, applications that monitor how many steps you take, how much you're exercising. We don't put any restrictions on what these teams do.
There's one big difference between the vision for the XPRIZE tricorder and Star Trek's. On Star Trek, medical professionals like Dr. Pulaski use the equipment.
How are you? Well, when I first called you, I was feeling intense pain.
But the focus of the XPRIZE tricorder competition is to put the technology in the hands of the consumer. That's right, you get to be Dr. McCoy. Here's a clip from a promo video for one of the products in the works from a U.S. team called Scanadu.
What if instead of fearing the worst when you notice something out of the ordinary, you could identify the condition yourself?
And this one's from a UK-based team called Zensor.
Detected arrhythmias and rate breaches are transmitted over standard Wi-Fi, with all vital signs monitored and recorded 24/7.
But Grant Campany says they're not trying to replace your family doctor.
I think it's a tool for physicians. I think what we're seeing, not only in this country but around the world, is that there's a tremendous shortage of doctors. We need to have innovation that allows us to have more tools and empowerment for consumers.
The 10 Qualcomm Tricorder XPRIZE finalists have until April to design, develop, and deliver up to 30 working tricorder devices. After that, consumer testers will take the devices home and evaluate them. Judges make the final decision in January 2016 to coincide with the 50th anniversary of Star Trek.